Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're talking with Bill Holden from the Marine Stewardship Council about all aspects of seafood sustainability. Let's get started. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name's Steph Bostuma. I'm your host, alongside my co-host, the Welshman Simon Evans.
G'day.
And to start our podcast, we would like to do an acknowledgement of country. We would like to acknowledge the people of the Dharawal Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and speak today, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. And today we find ourselves here at the headquarters of the Marine Stewardship Council here in Cronulla with our guest, Bill Holden. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Simon. Good morning. How are you guys today?
Good.
Not too bad.
Mate, we've got to start off by finding out a bit about you and about who you are. Like, what's your position at MSC? What do you do here?
Oh, yeah. Well, my job title is really long. I don't even remember it. But basically, I do fisheries outreach, and I'm more of a global person, and I specialize with tuna fisheries. So I work with tuna fishermen in the Pacific, and I oversee a few guys that are helping me in different oceans, in the Eastern Pacific, the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic. I work with tuna fisheries and fisheries that want to get certified. The MSC, Marine Stewardship Council, MSC, we're kind of, we specialize, we have different departments, whereas I do fisheries outreach, we have commercial outreach people, we have a whole, what we call the ivory tower of our standards people, and they're the one that make sure that everything's black and white with the MSC standard, and as fisheries outreach, I'm more in the gray areas and just kind of work with the fishermen. And being an ex-fisherman myself, it's quite easy, and I get along well with them. I like hanging out in a pub.
Yeah, cool. That's a good job. Let's start there, because obviously we've got plenty of time to talk about MSC and stuff and what they do. But tell us about your history as a tuna fisherman and stuff. Were you always a fisherman?
Yeah, so I grew up in San Diego, California. I'm a Yankee once upon a time, now an Aussie. And I started fishing there, bait fishing, and then went to university. And outside of university, I joined something called the Peace Corps. And it's a volunteer organization, and they sent me to the Kingdom of Tonga. And you know, at that time, that was back in '84. And at that time, I'm like, Tonga, where's Tonga? and we didn't have the internet back in '84, so I pulled out an atlas and I saw it was an island in the Pacific, and I thought, oh, you beauty. Perfect. I got to have surfing and fishing going on. So yeah. I went there for a 2-year stint and ended up staying 25, 26 years or so.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I picked up the language straight away and just started fishing with guys. And after my volunteer time, I worked for fisheries for a couple of years, and then I started my own fishing company and started snapper fishing and then tuna longlining. I was quite successful, so successful that I went from being a fisherman to being a businessman with like 80-odd employees and seven boats, and I didn't like it at that point.
You got in it just to be on the boat and go fishing,
exactly.
And instead you were stuck in the office.
Exactly. So I was out fishing actually in 2008, and I was looking through an Islands Business magazine, and there was an advert for a job with the Marine Stewardship Council. So I came in to shore, wrote a letter, put in my application, And 6 months later, I got the job.
Yeah, right.
So I started, went from tuna fishing to working for the MSC. I figured, hey, you know, I mean, I could see what was happening on the water. And no matter what I did, I wasn't really going to make that much of a difference. But I think with the MSC, I do make a difference.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. What was sustainability something that you wanted to practice while you were a fisherman in Tonga? Like, how did that journey sort of develop?
Yeah, you know, it's like when you start out, like anybody, when you're a kid, you don't really have much of a brain, and a teenager and stuff. And so you're just doing whatever you're being told to do. But I could see the way that I practice fishing versus the way other people did. And I could, you know, some fishermen, you have good years, you have bad years, good or bad seasons. But I could see some of the stuff that was being done, and I did a lot of reading, you know, and I could see some of the stuff that I was doing, you know, this wasn't the right thing to be doing. And so, you know, I actually looked into the MSC for our snapper fishery in Tonga, and that's how I first found out about, you know, got clued into, you look at the management, you look at everything else, it's just not, you know, is there more fish or less fish of what I'm trying to catch? So you look at everything. You look at all the other fish that are being caught with it, any impacts you're having on the environment as well as the management. And that's, you know, so when I came into MSC, I had a good idea of, you know, of what I saw. And so MSC's values and my values, we really, you know, they meshed together.
Mm.
So I was quite, it was a no-brainer for me, really.
So those sustainable practices, that just something that fishermen aren't aware of or just wouldn't be made aware of, just in doing their day-to-day kind of business? Is that something you need to search out?
Yeah, so there's two aspects. So yeah, awareness definitely is one thing, but also particularly, like, you know, I lived in Tonga for 25 years, and it's not only its awareness, but it's like it's their day-to-day life. You know, they're fishing to catch food.
Mm.
And so sustainability is like an afterthought. You know? It's like, I'm going to go out on the reef and I'm going to take all the shellfish that are closest to my house because it's quick and easy and closest to my house. And so you're thinking, I've got to, you know, and I guess when the populations were small, you could do that because the fish or the seafood had time to replenish. But as populations grow, and you'd see in the capital cities that you couldn't just go out to the reef and catch fish anymore.
Yeah.
So it's, I think in the back of your mind, you're thinking, yeah, I'm aware that this is not the right thing to be doing. But at the same time, you're thinking, well, you know, I gotta eat.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess if it's a lot of people thinking the same thing of it's not making that much of a difference that I'm doing it, but as soon as you have millions of people doing that, it makes a difference.
Yeah, it does. And so, I mean, of course, that's a Pacific Island experience. When you come into a Western world or a developed world, you know, like Australia, and you have rules in place and laws in place, well, then, you know, then that's when you have the management side of things comes in to help manage the fact that you just don't go on, you know, that's why you have quotas. That's why you have limits on how much, you know, how many cockles you can take off the beach and stuff and how many fish you can spear, you know, and that's, I guess, why you have government to put those laws in place. Otherwise, people have a tendency just to go and get the quickest, the slowest fish out in the water.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Marine Stewardship Council. We want to get a bit of an overview of, you know, what the organization is and some of the activities and programs that are involved. So do you want to just give us a brief overview of what it's here for, what you guys do?
Yeah, so the Marine Stewardship Council, we're a standard setter. So we're a not-for-profit, but we are a standard setter. And our standard is used to assess the sustainability of fisheries. We have two standards. We have a fishery standard, and we also have a chain of custody standard so that you can be assured that the fish, if you're buying from a sustainable or MSC certified fishery, the chain of custody standard says that everybody in that supply chain also follows certain rules and, you know, separation, segregation, identification, documentation, whatever, to get it to the consumer. But so what the MSC, it was first thought of, I guess, in 1997. And then it took a couple years of consultation and stakeholder meetings and whatnot, And it developed into the standard to assess the sustainability of fisheries, and by this, and so we were based on three principles. One, the sustainability of the stock that you're targeting. Two is your impacts on the environment, and the third principle is the management system that runs that fishery, both the general governance and also any fishery specific management regulations, I guess. And what that does is basically you're recognizing and you're rewarding fisheries for doing the right thing, for being sustainable. And you know what I term as sustainable is that basically you can fish today, tomorrow, and forever. So you only take out what you need, and you ensure that not only am I going to be able to fish, but my son's going to be able to fish, my grandchildren are going to be able to fish. To me, that's sustainability. And yeah. I think that's, you know, when the world wasn't so populated, that was an easy thing to do. Mm. But as you know, we become more developed and fishing techniques become more efficient, there's a requirement to have these standards in place so that, you know, and to assess fisheries against the sustainability of can we keep fishing. And we've seen fisheries on the brink and come back, you know, but and there's some good news stories out there, but there's also, you know, there's still some places are still the Wild West, you know, and people are just going, you know, hell for leather.
Yeah, I mean, it's when there's money involved, people always do that. So maybe let's go into, I think something across all boards is sustainability, and sustainable just gets used as a term. And for chefs and consumers, don't ever go too detailed into what these terms mean. So maybe if you want to go through some of the things that would be bad practices, something that are good practices, some things that you look at to deem whether a fishery is sustainable or not.
Yeah, okay. So with the MSC, we actually, we don't differentiate between fishing gears or fishing practices. The only thing is explosives and poisons. So if you're, you know, or of course, marine mammals, but explosives and poisons, if you're using those fishing methods, you wouldn't even be within scope of trying to get certified. Yeah. But we don't differentiate between what type of gear, because every fishery has their own gear, their own sets of issues. And so what we've had to do is create a standard that is global that can be applied to all fisheries. And that's the difficulty. And when the MSC first started 23 years ago, there was no such thing as a standard to compare fisheries against. So we've created, so the MSC has a standard which is, able to be applied globally to assess the sustainability of fisheries. So we don't look at gears.
Okay.
Some people say ban this or no super trawlers or this. You know, we don't do that.
But I mean, that's something that you generally found is trawling bad, line caught good, and that's about as much as me as a chef gets a lot of time. So with the MSC, in the cases that it's more about other peripheral issues rather than those methods of catching.
Yeah, it's more okay. First is the stock that you're catching, is it healthy?
Yeah,
you know, is it healthy? And the way you're catching it, what's your impact on the environment?
Mm.
So if it's bottom trawling, what's your impact on the ocean floor? If it's using FADS is another one, fish aggregating devices for tuna fishing. They really, you know, Greenpeace used to run a campaign, ban the FADS, without really knowing what they were banning. But it's because of the bycatch that's being caught. And also, you know, 10 years ago, FADS, the design of FADS were such that there was a lot of entanglement issues, like with turtles and whatnot, where they've really improved on stuff like that. And that's something else with our standard is that what we say at MSC is that, you know, we're not making science, but we're like just behind the crest of the wave. So we follow the best science. So our standard is always evolving. We every 5 years, we do a review of our standard, which involves stakeholders. And so with this, we look at the latest science and we go with what is the best practice. Mm. And that way, because, and you know, some people say, oh, you're raising the bar. No, we know more. The more information you have, the better the science is.
The bar's evolving.
Exactly. Mm. You can't stand still. You can't, like, you know, build a standard, build it in stone. It's not the Ten Commandments.
So when it comes to the fisheries that are assessed, like how are those fisheries selected? Does the MSC sort of basically use the science available globally to assess all fisheries?
Yeah, so this is actually a voluntary program. It's a market-based program.
Right.
So it's the consumers. Well, we say it's the consumers, but if you come down to it, it's, you know, it's the Coles, the Woolies, the Aldis. It's them thinking, everybody wants me to be seen to be green, type of thing. And so, you know, we by purchasing fish from an MSC certified fishery, you know, they're ticking off that box for themselves for their corporate social responsibility. Mm. It's a voluntary program. It's market based. Fisheries come to us, and what you see with the MSC or what you see with fisheries coming into the program is initially maybe their market has asked them, we need you to be assessed, you know, we need to see how sustainable you are. A good way to do that is to get MSC certified. Mm. And then the initial people that do that, they get a premium, you know, they get market access or they get a price premium for this. But then it becomes, you know, the next fishery down the road is going, well, why aren't you buying my fish anymore? Well, yeah, you know, okay. Can you prove you're sustainable? Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I got to do this.
Yeah.
And by the market recognizing the sustainability of a fishery, and it's our theory of change that you get some people that are assessed and they're proven to be sustainable. And then, you know, the markets are going, well, I know you guys are like next door neighbors. Your fishery is probably sustainable as well, but you know, you kind of got to prove it. Mm-hmm. So it's voluntary, but it's also a cycle of, I guess, you know, once somebody's in it, everybody else has got to get on the road too.
Mm. We said this before with other issues. It's very much, you said, kind of market driven, consumer driven. As soon as a consumer demands that their products are certified, then you know, the big shops get on it, and that has a trickle down and trickle across effect. And it is very much when there's more awareness about it and consumers demand it, everything else will follow eventually. You hope.
Yeah, and that's the way we like I say, we call it our theory of change. You know, when you know, one fishery comes in and they're proving this, and the people and the market demand is there, then others come along. And you know, even if fisheries don't get MSC certified, it just raises the performance and it raises the awareness so that people are more aware of sustainability. And I think that's important, even if you're not MSC certified, to be aware of what you're doing, the impact you're having. Mm. And not, like I said, not only on the fish you have, but, you know, what other impacts you have, you know. You know, 20, 30 years ago, people used to throw rubbish in the ocean like it was nothing. You know? And now people think twice. You know, when I was a teenager, a deckhand on a boat, you know, you change the oil out at sea, you just dump the oil in the ocean. You know? Now you bring it on shore and somebody dumps it somewhere else. But.
Yeah. Small changes. You can't fight everything. Once on land, it's past your responsibility.
I'm trying to think of which of the two questions I have in my head I'll ask first. I want to talk about seafood sustainability in general, because you said something really interesting before, which was that you can fish, your children can fish, and future generations can fish forever. And there may be a misconception out there that seafood can be a perpetually sustainable industry, that wild caught seafood can be perpetually sustainable indefinitely. People sort of think it's a extraction of wild resource. How can this be something that is viable, you know, far down the track into the future? So like, what is it, can you explain to us, what is it about fish and about fisheries that allow themselves to sort of replenish and restock? Because as you said, we've had cases of fisheries that have been pushed to the brink, and using proper management practices, proper, you know, sustainability practices and things like that have come back and have allowed us to have a sustainable fishery in that instance. So what is it about fish and seafood, and how does that work?
Yeah, well, fish, you have to understand, because fish is, it's not like a forest where you can count the trees. Mm. So you can't count all the fish. So scientists make their best guesstimate of how much fish are down there. And what, you know, so what, the way that when you do stock assessments and you're trying to see basically how much the, you know, how much fish are there, what's the biomass that's left. And they generally say that you don't want to take it down too low to a level where the fish can't reproduce fast enough to keep up with the fishery. But you can fish to a certain level so that it, you know, the fish are able to reproduce and maintain the fishery that's working on that, that's catching those fish. It's kind of, and again, it's a best estimate. So the more data, the more information you have, and there's so many fishery scientists that are just trying to figure out how much fish are down there. Mm. And there's other, you know, and not only the fishery impacts, you know, there's, if it's an inshore fishery, there could be impacts from runoff from the rivers. Climate change, boy, that's really changing the way we're seeing that happening in the Northeast Atlantic, where some of the mackerel, the herring fisheries are now, you know, there's countries over there that have quotas, but now the fisher have moved further north to countries that never fished it before, and they're going, you beauty, we look at all the fish we've got now. Yeah, right. Wait, you, that's not your quota. Yeah, it's in our water. What do we do?
Yeah, right.
and I think probably like with tuna fisheries in the Pacific, we're going to see that as well. It's a 20, 30, 40, 50 year time span, but we're going to see, and we'll see it along the east coast of Australia as well. We'll see, you know, the range of where species are being caught, are available to be caught, or just where they're living is going to change. So the sustainability, you've got all those factors, not just the fishery. You know, you've got to consider the whole environment. Mm. And is it going to be, you know, and that's the role of managers. And here in Australia, AFMA, the Australia Fisheries Management Authority, they manage the Commonwealth fisheries, and I think they do a great job. You know, I'd give them a shout out, because they actually are looking after the Commonwealth, you know, up to the EZ or the 200 mile zone of Australia. Mm. They do a good job of managing that, and they plan for all these contingencies. Mm. You know, how much fish can we take? What is going to happen with climate change? Do we have any IUU, illegal, unreported or unregulated fishing happening in our waters? So there's a lot of factors, I guess, to weigh in, not just the fishing.
I guess it's probably good to kind of point out, and Fuji always say that you're always staying on the data, and it's a constantly changing thing. That it's always going to be adjusting these levels of stocks and what you can take, and it's going to be something that does change as other things change, and then it's more about keeping on top of the data than setting hard and fast rules that are going to see us through years to come.
Yeah, well, that goes back to it's not set in stone. So as the science gets better, as you get more information and more data, then of course the rules and the regulations are going to change. There's countless, and technology is improving the way that data is gathered, I guess, and what you're able to see down underneath the ocean. And maybe one day it will be like counting the trees in the forest. You can count the fish.
Yeah.
And then we'll have more of a spot on. But you also have to look at, what was the fish population before anybody started fishing?
Yeah.
Mm. And so we know that, okay, it's not going to be a virgin population anymore, but, can you fish it at a level that it can still maintain itself and be sustainable? I mean, fish is not the only protein in the world, and wild-caught fish, I love it, but it's not going to feed the entire globe. Mm. So there's other sources, but I think it contributes to, you know, if fisheries are well managed and are sustainable, they'll contribute to our a source of food for us forever.
Yeah. Mm.
How does Australia, so in terms of like the number of fisheries we have in Australia, how, like, do you know how many or approximately how many are MSC certified or have come forward?
The number of them, I don't. There's Commonwealth fisheries. There's a lot in WA. There's none here in New South Wales, but it's would be over 40% of the volume of fish caught in Australia is MSC certified.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have that number.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But that's a good.
But we, I mean, Australia does very well. One, we're a big country with a small population, and also, and so that just allows the fish to be, you know, at high health stocks. It's well managed, as I mentioned, AFMA, and also the state fisheries departments. You know, they manage the fisheries well. And you just have to look at some of our neighboring countries. You know, unfortunately, there's much more populated areas to the north of us in Asia, and their inshore fisheries are just devastated.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, because it just, the population is just too big, and the management does not exist at a local level.
Mm. Mm. But Australia as a country, I mean, it seems on the surface that we are good here and we have good practices, and it seems like we have access to good seafood. So Australia on the whole is kind of leading the way, or you know, are we middle ground, or how are we looking as a country on a worldwide scale?
I think every country would like to think they're leading the way. I would say definitely we're holding our own in Australia. I think the amount of regulations we have in place is good. It's not overburdensome.
Yeah.
You know, some of the EU rules and regulations would be, you know, it's a nightmare. You know, if you're a skipper on a boat, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, right.
You move 10 miles this way, and next thing you know, you're under another regulation, and you basically got to have a volume of books with you to see what you're doing. The United States has very complicated regulations and rules and regulations depending on the state, depending on their federal system. So I think Australia, we're holding our own. I think we've got the right balance of management and still allowing the fisheries to be profitable and to be successful.
Cool.
So I think one thing I want to gain an understanding of is, as people in hospitality, like, you know, the marquee fish of the world that everyone wants is bluefin tuna, but and we know that there are issues around tuna, say, like, and there are a lot of different species of tuna and things like that from a lot of different fisheries all around the world. And so I think that there's a lot of people who know that there's bad stuff and know that there's stuff that you can get that's good as well, but none of it's really clear. Do you see the same thing, Simon?
Yeah, I think most people would have an idea that there's something's not quite right with tuna fishing, and that something needs to be done, but they don't quite know what. But I don't think it really stops people enjoying tuna at a restaurant or buying it at a supermarket from a can. So maybe we can delve into tuna and work out what we need to know as a consumer or as a chef.
Yeah, so with tuna, and it's a bit unique compared to other fisheries, because, you know, your snapper fishery is, the snapper is only going to be in a range of maybe 50 miles. Your shellfish, they're pretty much just going to be right in front of you. Mm. But with the tuna fisheries, they swim long distances. You brought up the southern bluefin tuna. That is beautiful. And that's actually a good news story, I guess, a good story, because that was a case where, before it was properly managed, the Japanese had been down here basically IUU fishing for, I don't know how long, since they started, I guess, and not reporting what they were catching. And it took some investigation, and in the Japanese market, they were seeing so much more southern bluefin tuna being sold than the fishermen were actually reporting being caught. And so they set up a tuna commission, for the southern bluefin tuna, because they catch it in New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Indonesia. It's one of these that just migrates across the southern oceans. And once they started getting the correct data, and they put in harvest strategies to actually bring down the catches and manage it, and they got the correct reporting, and that stock is rebuilding. The most recent stock assessment now has that stock at up above a level that's, I mean, it still needs to improve, but it's on the right trajectory. So that's good. But tuna fisheries in general, so they're all managed by what we call, they're called acronyms, RFMOs, but regional fishery management organizations. And there's one in the Western Central Pacific, there's one in the Eastern Pacific, one in the Atlantic, one in the Indian Ocean. And these organizations are basically bodies of governments, of the governments, so that the governments that fish in the area, and also distant water fleets, the governments that represent distant water fleets. So for instance, for Australia, we're members of the Indian Ocean Tuna Commission, as a WA, and we're also members of the Western Central Pacific Fisheries Commission because of the Pacific fisheries. But they're difficult. They're because it's not a voting type of decision making process. It's a consensus, and because of that, actually, you always reach the lowest common denominator that everybody wants to agree on, which makes it very difficult. And you have competing interests, like in the Western Central Pacific. You've got the Pacific Island nations, which have huge EEZs, even though they're small countries, and so they pretty much. The fish, when it's swimming through their oceans, it's their fish. Same, Australia has our 200-mile zone. But then you have, you know, countries, the Europeans, you have the various Asian countries coming down to fish. And so, you know, they buy rights to fish. But at these tuna commissions, they've all got to agree how best are we going to manage this tuna. And this is why in different oceans, what they don't agree. And you get the lowest common denominator. Like in the Indian Ocean, yellowfin, it's overfished, and overfishing is still going on, and they can't agree on how to rebuild it because of the competing interest. And you've got the competing interest of the small island states and the Europeans. In the Western Central Pacific, we're actually in a unique position because of all the Pacific islands. They have ownership. The Atlantic doesn't have those islands. The Eastern Pacific doesn't have those islands. And so nobody has ownership. So it's more of a high seas fishery. And it's more difficult to manage when it's on the high seas because nobody, it's basically winner takes all type of thing. And nobody wants to come to an agreement. So we have different stocks. I mean, you have to look at the main commercial stocks that you would be eating at a restaurant. Of course, there's the bluefin, and there's different... different stocks of bluefin. We have the southern bluefin tuna, which is we're more familiar with here, but you have Atlantic tuna, which is there's both the East Atlantic and the Western Atlantic, which is off the U.S. So that's the bluefin tuna, the big eye tuna. You have big eye in all the different oceans. You have yellowfin in all the different oceans. You have skipjack and albacore in all the oceans. Like I said, in the Indian Ocean. Yellowfin is overfished, and overfishing is going on. You know, if you're looking at a rating chart, it's in the red. We're very fortunate because of the Pacific Islands that all of our Western Central Pacific tuna stocks are healthy. They would be in the green, so you can be assured. And it's because of the management that's going on. And tuna, you know, they you can fish them hard, and they rebuild. If you just ease the pressure off a bit, and they come back real quick. I mean, skipjack in particular, what you're going to find in most of your cans of tuna, I mean, it's like cockroaches. you fish as hard as you can, and the scientists come back and say, well, I don't know, there seems to be more.
So it sounds like an absolute logistical nightmare to bring multiple countries, multiple interests, multiple waters together to any sort of consensus to get any regulation on tuna. That just seems mind-boggling from the start.
Well, yes, I mean, so and that's why you need to have management in place before the tuna gets into an overfished state. Mm. And this is one of the things, like with the MSC standard, that, you know, that we look at, you know, are there harvest strategies in place? Are there harvest control rules in place so that, you know, so that if the tuna goes down to a level, you know, it hits a trigger point, and then we say, okay, we pull the trigger. Now here's our strategy to rebuild, you know, and you do that, and you got rules and controls in place, you know, like you reduce the fishing effort or you limit the amount of catch, and that's all part of management, and so that and that's what's so difficult to agree, because nobody wants to reduce their catch, and when it's already in an overfished state, it's even harder to get people to agree to those. When like if I say to you, you know, okay, you can have 20 ice creams after dinner, and you might go,
I'll take them.
you go, okay. But if I go in the freezer and I see there's one ice cream left, and I go, oh, no ice cream for you tonight, man. You're going to go, whoa, where's my 20 ice creams?
Dude, this is working. This is devastating to me. That thought is just horrible. Oh, my God.
yeah, so that's why, you know, it's important to have this management in place. Mm. Before you hit those, and it's not tuna, but any stock, before it gets down to that level.
And so as consumers, like how do we identify what tuna we can or should be buying?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, unless you're really switched on, you know, and you know, you know, you read the can, or you look at, or you ask the fishmonger, where's that tuna from? You know, for us, I mean, the Bluefish Tick MSC. I got to do a bit of a promo there.
Yeah, no, 100%.
We'll talk about that in a sec too, because we'll talk about some other things.
Yeah, because it, you know, it's an easy way to know that fishery has been measured and has come up as sustainable against a globally recognized standard.
Mm. So, which tuna fisheries have the tick?
Oh, wow.
Which tin is there, should lots? I be buying?
There's a lot. Maybe not tinned, so more so sort of yellowfin and bluefin, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is so, the chef prized, yeah, sort of tunas. Okay.
So depends on your work. Tuna in a tin might be chef prized for some people.
Well,
making little sandwiches.
I love tuna in a tin. It's great.
Yeah, me too.
Me too.
Yeah.
is that the most consumed tuna? Is tinned? Would that be the case?
Oh, yeah, I would say so, yes, definitely. Because there's more skipjack in the world than cockroaches.
Yeah.
You don't want a cockroach in a can, though.
Insects are the future of protein. Yeah.
So. And that's mainly what you're buying in a tin of tuna.
Okay.
Yellowfin and skipjack. But no, there's a lot. I mean, if you're in Japan, I would say no, not tin tuna. I'd say it's fresh tuna.
Yeah, yeah.
I eat a lot of, I like going to the fishmonger and buying yellowfin, or albacore steaks. I just buy my stuff fresh, and what fisheries are certified? There's globally for tuna, they're in every ocean.
Yeah, okay.
So even in the Indian Ocean, even though the yellowfin's in trouble, there's skipjack fisheries that over there that are certified as MSC certified as sustainable. In the Western Central Pacific, we have longline fisheries, we have purse seine fisheries, we have pole and line fisheries. These are all different fishing methods that are all certified. And here in Australia, the entire eastern tuna billfish fishery is MSC certified. And I think that's a great story in itself.
Mm, let's talk a bit about that. So tell us a bit about that eastern fishery.
Yeah, so 6 years ago, there was a family, Paavo and Heidi Walker, in the Mooloolaba. And they wanted to, you know, stand out and show that their catches were sustainable. So they got MSC certified. And it was great for them. It still is great for them. They opened new markets for their swordfish, their yellowfin, and their albacore was all certified. It's a longline fishery.
So was that their main product? Swordfish, albacore,
absolutely. Yeah. So they're a longline fishing company, based in Mooloolaba, and then and they were catching albacore, yellowfin, swordfish. You know, depending on the season.
We used to get some of that albacore. It still really stands out. I think a long time ago when I was working in hospitality, I remember the Mooloolaba albacore coming in.
Yeah, no, it's good. They're nice, big, mature fish. It's a good, and it's actually one of the cuts of tuna that people don't don't buy that much. It's white. It's more whiter and not red like yellow.
Chicken of the sea.
Yeah, chicken of the sea. And it's cheaper. And I actually prefer. I like it. It's good for steaks.
It's much cheaper too. Cheaper.
It's much cheaper than yellowfin. It started with them, and then so the way the MSC standard works, our certification is you're certified for 5 years, and every year you have an annual surveillance audit to make sure that you know you're maintaining, you're doing the right stuff, you're keeping up with the conditions of your certification. So when they went for reassessment to go for recertification, Tuna Australia, it's an association of the tuna fisheries, they took up the certification and became what we call the client as MSC certified. And so now it's moved from just the Walker family in Walker Seafoods in Mooloolaba to the entire Eastern Tuna Billfish Fishery, and all the fishing companies are certified. So it's now like 34 odd vessels. Unfortunately, it's not the Southern Bluefin Tuna is not involved. I'm sure they'd love to get that certified. And to me, the way it's rebuilding, it should be able one day, but I know that it's classified. What is it classified? It's one of our endangered or protected species here in Australia. National legislation. I'm not sure what it is.
What are the main methods of how do people normally take the southern bluefin, like in Australian waters? What's the catch method?
The main one is the purse seiners go head out of South Australia, out of Port Lincoln, and go put a net around them, and then they put them into cages, towing cages, and then they bring them into South Australia, and they actually ranching. So right. they feed them sardines, which of course the South Australian sardine fishery is certified as well as MSC certified. So they feed them sardines, and then they ship, you know, they take them as the market requires them. But the East Coast fishery catches them on long lines.
Yep.
So they come up. You know, they don't go all the way up to Queensland, but they come up to wherever the water temperature, and I think the line moves, AFMA moves the line up in north and south. So there is some caught, maybe 1,000 tons a year on long line. What makes its way to the market here would be probably some of the long line fish, as well as some of the fish out of South Australia that's not destined for the export market.
Cool. Let's talk about, you know, we don't have too much longer to go, but let's talk about consumers as a bit more in terms of, you know, what are some species people should be looking for? As you sort of mentioned before, people, you know, will go to the fishmonger and demand the salmon, demand the snapper, maybe flathead. It's just what people are familiar with, you know what I mean? So are there some fisheries that sort of stand out here in Australia or globally that people should be on the lookout for, or species like a skipjack, like a cockroach, that will just always be sustainable and continues to be sustainable, that are better choices for people?
Look, I'm not going to spruik one species over another, other than tuna.
All fish are equal.
I just would say, you know, don't be afraid. Go in there and talk to your fishmonger, and look for freshness. You know, just there's plenty of YouTube videos to tell you how fresh fish is. You know, if you don't know, don't be afraid. And the more you get at it, the better you are. You know, talk to people. It's easy to spot fresh fish from not so fresh fish. I mean, anything you buy in Australia is generally going to be sustainable. It's going to be good. You know, it's just the way that our supply chain works here in this country. You don't really have too much to worry about that it's going to be an unsustainable speed. You know, it's on its deathbed type of fish.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Let's talk about supply chain too then, because that's the second aspect of what MSC does that we haven't yet talked about. How do you guys go about certifying chain of custody and those sorts of things?
Yeah, so our chain of custody is our standard for the supply chain, and that works for so that people are assured that, and it only works, you have to purchase initially from a certified fishery. So you know it's coming from a sustainable fishery, which is MSC certified. But then every link in the supply chain from the first buyer, whether it be at the dockside or whether it be at auction or to the wholesaler, to the fishmonger, to the retailer, to the restauranter, they all have to be MSC certified. And that is so that they have to have systems in place, traceability systems, basically, where, you're identifying that this is this species and this is from this fishery, and you're keeping it separate, so you're not throwing all the fillets in together with mixing everything else. And this is actually, you'll hear and you can read about a lot of surveys or sampling that's being done globally about the amount of mislabeled fish.
I've read a study about this.
Yeah.
There were some pretty bad examples of things being mislabeled.
Yeah, whether it's done deliberately or whether it's just through ignorance. Mm. But I mean, deliberate, it's easy. If I can sell you some cheap white fillet.
White fillet. I mean, people wouldn't know what most things look like.
And I pay $5 for it, and I can turn around and sell it for $25 because I'm calling it something else.
Marinara mix.
Yeah. So what the MSC, what our chain of custody standard does is, one, you're assured it's coming from a sustainable fishery, but two, you're also the amount of mislabeling. I mean, the MSC has done we do trace backs. We've done DNA testing. Mm. And yes, there are some incidences where fish has been mislabeled that we've discovered. Like we'll go and we'll pull stuff off the shelves, and we'll send samples to the lab and have that tested to make sure that what they are selling is what they say they are selling.
Mm. Mm. Which means it's quite important because the consumer would be fairly ignorant to what fish look like, and also. Fish get called by a lot of different names by different people in different countries a lot of time. Like one of the first things I had to do when I moved here was literally learn just similar fish that are called different things, and then learn all the new fish that were here. It was kind of like starting from the beginning of what we could source, what we could use, how to cook it. So it's kind of a lot of confusion there. So I imagine that can happen, and the consumer wouldn't be particularly aware of it happening.
Yeah, and particularly if you're looking at a restaurant. You've pretty much got to trust what the owners are telling you is the fish of the day. Particularly like a white fish, how are you going to know? Mm. I mean, some like mahi-mahi or tuna, somebody says, oh, I've got snapper, and it comes out and I can see it's a tuna. I'm going to go, wait a minute, guys.
Yeah.
But maybe not, then that's me as who knows fish.
Mm.
Maybe somebody else, wouldn't know.
Yeah. The amount of things that are called cod.
Oh, everything's a cod.
I still don't think I have my head around all the different cods and the differences being.
Snappers a lot different. Yeah. What you hear in Australia as to what it is overseas as well. They're more sort of maybe in the emperor mangrove jack sort of family compared to the big red snapper we have here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, snapper's a good one. Again, I started snapper fishing in Tonga, and it was a completely different snapper. And there's a deep water snapper, and there's a shallow water snapper. And we used to export like 11 different species of snapper. And whatever they sold it for in the U.S., what they called it, I wouldn't have known back then, in the 80s and 90s. So, and the snapper we have here, compared, say, Northern Territory or Queensland, they have the tropical snapper and the gold band snapper and stuff. And that's to me, that's a snapper. This is a snapper.
Yeah. I mean, even as chefs, a lot of time you would just order, like, could I get 5 snapper for tomorrow, please? Like, you wouldn't particularly have the information to specify which one you want. And you kind of guess then you're trusting another step. You're trusting your fishmonger to get you something that is correct and sustainable and good. So I think having that traceability the whole way down the line, because everyone is relying on that last person to provide them with the right details, have accountability with that, put some confidence in chefs and consumers and everyone else that they're getting the right thing.
Mm. Yeah, I would say it's particularly for chefs, having a good relationship with your fishmonger.
Yeah.
Because not only that, you might say, oh, I want 5 snapper. And he'll say, oh, man, I've got, check out these flatheads I got. They're just like fresh off the boat.
Yeah.
And if I, I don't run a restaurant, but I think if I was, or if I was a buyer for a restaurant, I would always be going, what do you got fresh?
Yeah.
And then I'd be telling my chef, this is going to be the special.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, no, for sure. It's definitely good to have a good relationship. I find the problem with fishmongers is they're up far too early. So when I get a text at 6 a.m. and they're like, oh, I've got this, is looking great. I'm not in the mood to make a decision that time in the morning when I probably haven't had much sleep yet.
Yeah. Why do they get up so early?
Because of the markets, they're going
to
be there.
Yeah, but why do the fish markets have to start at fucking 2 in the morning?
Because they've got to get delivery by... I mean, it would be better to do it like a day. If everyone could get their orders in 40 hours early, that would be probably better. They've got to get their orders out to some restaurants. You know, like we want our order by midday down in Shoalhaven. They've got to get the fish from Sydney.
Right, okay.
So they've got to start early, haven't they? I'd rather it was like, a day ahead, and I could just chat to them in the Arvo and be like, well, what are you going to the market for tonight?
Yeah.
See what they got.
No, I think fishermen, I mean, again, being an ex-fisherman, I still get up at 4 in the morning. It's just, and even though I'm getting up to go sit at my computer and read emails, you know, it's just, it's my habit.
It's built in now.
I'm in bed by 9, but.
Yeah.
Do you still fish recreationally and stuff, Bill?
Not really. I found when I first came here from Tonga, I found that when I went out fishing with guys, they expected me to do everything. I gotta put the hooks on, bait the hooks.
That's my role a lot of the time. Sometimes when I take sort of amateur fishermen out on my boat, it's like I spend more time undoing tangles and getting snags off and showing people how to bait their hook and stuff like that than I do fishing myself.
God forbid you catch a fish, because then you got to clean it.
Yeah, well, you also like, they kind of like, once they get it to the boat, they don't know what to do with it. You're like, all right, here you go. I'll grab the fish. I'll take the hook out. I'll put it in the ice. And
that's why I stick to cooking them.
Yeah. So yeah, I didn't come to Australia to be a deckhand.
No. There you go. That's exactly right. I've actually had some of the best times on my boat just by myself with two lines in the water.
I agree there.
What do you have personal, like, we're just talking about fish now because we're all fish mad, but do you have some personal favorites of like fish that you like to source or like to eat? Anything you've got a special affinity with? I suppose tuna is one of them we've talked about.
Yeah, tuna. Or have you eaten enough tuna that you're sick of it now?
Look, I eat fresh tuna. I'm not adverse to popping open a can of tuna and putting it on a sandwich at lunchtime. But also, you know, I like swordfish. I just love fish and I love seafood. I love oysters. You know, I love clams, cockles. Lobster, prawns. I love it all. Yeah.
Do you think that there's, I don't know, like some, you know, people who have a background in fishing and love fish and stuff, I almost sort of make an analogy to hunting where, I don't know, people who consume meat these days are sort of under the microscope a bit more, meat and seafood by people who choose not to eat meat or seafood and things like that. You know, there's like growing activism around animal welfare and around sustainability and stuff. Some of it can be a little bit misguided in terms of how much they're educated about things like sustainability. But do you feel like there's something about, well, you know, you can consume fish, seafood and all that sort of stuff, and because of your connection with it, because you spent so long on the water and things like that, you can still consume all these things but still have a really deep appreciation for it, and it also makes, like, it almost makes you have more of an appreciation for it and a better understanding of these animals when you consume them, if you know what I mean. It's like a more sustainable and ethical approach to consumption because of an understanding. You know, a lot of people would say, well, if you really appreciate these animals, you just wouldn't eat them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, I actually came up against a campaigner when I first moved to Australia. And when I explained, an oceans campaigner, I'm not going to say what NGO, but when I explained that I was a fisherman, and they said, oh, they just got so down on me, basically saying every fish you take out of the water is another hole in the ocean. And I'm like, what are you on about? You know, I mean, it's, I appreciate fish. Again, this is the whole, people need to be aware. People need to be knowledgeable. You know, you can't be afraid of, you know, you shouldn't be afraid of what stuff you don't know, I guess. And I think that, you know, this is why my values really gel with the MSC, is because, you know, we do assessments. We look at fisheries and we look and see, you know, are they sustainable? And, you know, we can keep pulling the fish out of the water, because and I'm convinced, and the science says that we can keep doing that. So to avoid fish, to not eat fish, is the wrong attitude to have.
Yeah, I think it's the same as the meat industry. It's about eating better, being more knowledgeable about where you're buying from and what you're eating, than cutting out altogether. Because that's really not a global solution to anything, to saying like, nah, no more fish, because you would ruin industries and communities and you know, where are people going to replace these things in their diet from? So it's definitely about having organizations who can point people in the right direction of how can you eat better.
Yeah. It's also like, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, Simon, when we were sort of prepping, is that recognition that you aren't going to stop people from consuming what they want to consume in this world. That's just not how the world works. Like, people want to eat their meat, people want to eat their fish, and the recognition that you're not going to stop them from doing so means that you go to the next step, which is how can we help people and help industries and help, you know, consumers and distributors and chefs and all those sorts of things understand and make it easy for them to be able to make better decisions when they do consume these things, which is, yeah.
Well, I mean, fish is healthy and it's tasty. Yeah. I mean, why would you want to avoid that?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost something that a lot of people don't eat fish at all in Australia. Like, the amount of people,
it's interesting people who don't like seafood. I guess what you're saying?
Yeah, like probably close to as many vegans or vegetarians would have no seafood eaters.
I didn't know that.
In my anecdotal experience of running restaurants, or close to, they would have a lot, especially in Wollongong.
I would think Australians living on the coast would be like, you know, huge.
This is what I thought. I mean, it's similar in the UK. Like in south of England and Wales, most of our seafood goes export to Europe, to France and Spain. And British don't eat that much seafood, even though it's a small island with a large coastline. But yeah, some people just don't eat seafood when it's very good for you, and it can be a sustainable resource. So maybe a lot of people, especially some like people, are not. I'm a meat eater. I just eat meat. Probably need to actually eat more seafood and less meat to help sort of balance out their protein intake.
Why is that? You think that's because they're uneducated,
a bit of possibly down to when you couldn't get fresh seafood. People have that scaredness of like fishy fish,
right?
Like, where people were like, what's is it like? The question we'd get asked quite often would be like, especially if we had some slightly different fish on that people hadn't seen or heard of, would be like, is it a fishy fish? And it's like, what the fuck do you mean? Like, yes, it's a fish. Like, but generally they were asking, is it a smelly fish? So I think that kind of leads me to say that a lot of people's bad experiences have come from bad quality and not fresh fish, where it's been close to being off, and that's put people off. So I think a lot of it might have been why people have an aversion to seafood, would be bad experience or quality, or even bad experiences from, you know, from family members, and they never ate fish because, you know, fish is yuck or fish is gross.
I wonder if it's like a cultural thing here in Australia as well, because this might be completely incorrect, but the people that I'm thinking of who say I don't like fish, or I don't like prawns, or I don't like seafood, are, you know, like a couple of generations Aussie.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, yeah. Like me having a Mediterranean background, and people that I know that sort of have a bit of ethnicity wherever it might be, that are usually the ones that are a bit more adventurous in the food that they eat and stuff like that. But I know that, like, the old school Australian family, the classic is just the meat and three veg sort of thing. You just have a piece of lamb, a piece of beef, and put some sausages, and that was like cooked, on rotation all
some
week.
Cooked prawns, that'd be it.
Cooked prawns on a special occasion.
You're fine
maybe.
With that.
Yeah.
The people from Wales, I guess.
Yeah.
The people originally from Wales.
Where, Wales?
If you don't have cod, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah. So the UK's pretty bad with it as well. Like, I think it comes from a weird sort of Christian background of not eating, or Protestant background, not eating fish on certain days, and it was a sin to eat fish on Fridays or every other day ended in a Y or something like that. So there's some weird inbuilt guilt things in the UK, I think, about it.
I think it's I don't know, there's probably a number of different factors, right? Like, I think that a lot of people just like, fish look weird, and they're like they're slimy, and they've got like small bones and scales and things like that as well. And it's just like a bit of an ick factor for some people.
Well, I think that starts as a child. I know even my son. Yes, what are we having for dinner, Dad? I'm having fish
again.
Are there bones in it?
Again, again.
Which is why swordfish and tuna is so good, because there's no bones. No bones when you're getting a nice loin or a steak or something. But like I love baking whole fish, and really, he once he sees a whole fish come out of the oven, he's the dread on his face. Like, oh shit, bones.
Yeah, I guess like. Yeah, people just get used to fish and chips as a starting point as well. And that's like just soft, sweet, white meat with no bones covered in like deep fried batter, which is pretty approachable when it comes to fish, you know. If you can't down some fish and chips, like you probably don't like a lot of stuff. Mm. All right, well, I don't know if we use this to finish off, but I kind of, your position as a global outreach guy here at MSC, How do you see seafood sustainability on a global level? Because as we mentioned, we've got a lot of neighbours, very populous neighbours, and then we also briefly mentioned high seas, which you know don't have the same amount of regulation, and I'm assuming maybe there's not the same level of science going on like right in the middle of the Pacific as there is inshore.
There is the same level of science, but the thing is they're lacking the data.
Right.
You know, what you get from a lot of subsistence fisheries are artisanal fisheries up through Asia, you know, small scale, and is that you got guys coming, you know, one or two guys on a boat going out for half a day, coming in. You know, they're eating half of their catch, and they're sharing, or they're trading, or they're selling a little bit, and there's no data on that. And that's what makes those fisheries more difficult to manage, is that lack of data. And so, you know, on a global level, how are fisheries going? And you know, there's a lot of prophets of doom out there that, you know, there's gonna be no fish by 2040 and 2050 or whenever. But you can't make a generalization about fish. You know, there's areas where it's overfished and overfishing is going on, and you can't do anything to stop it because the governments don't have the resources. But then there's other areas where, you know, the fish stocks are, most areas actually, where the fish stocks are healthy. So you can't make a global generalization about, you know, well, we're going to run out of fish or we're going to have fish forever. You have to look at it region by region. Which is why I say, you know, I think Australia's got the right mix of the amount of fish that we catch and the way the fisheries are managed here. And I think Australians have really, you know, no need to worry about the fish that's being sold to them, because it's definitely going to be coming from a sustainable source.
Mm. I mean, that's great to know for everyone in Australia buying seafood, really, that you it's hopefully harder to go wrong. It's to kind of get something right.
I think consumers in Australia need to definitely feel safe and educate yourself about fish. And you know, you talked about the quality. Is it fishy fish? And you know, learn how to buy good fish. You know, and you know, if you've got a local fishmonger, you know, even if you're going into one of the supermarkets, you know, they usually have fish counters there, and you know. The people behind that staff those fish counters are trained in seafood, just like, you know, behind the meat counter they're trained in meat. So they're trained to know what they're selling. They're trained to know, you know, this is good. You know, ask questions. That you know.
So many of these conversations we have always come back to communication with the people that sell you your food.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, figure out who it is that sells you your food. If you can get the name of the person that sells you your food, that's even better, and start a relationship
with
them.
So on the MSC website, is there a list of suppliers and producers, or is there where is this information accessible?
Oh yeah, so the MSC, we do have lists, you know, pick a supplier type of list, so you can find out, you go, because we're a global organization, but we have a regional website as well for MSC, and you can just put in what species you're looking for, and you can find suppliers in your area. And you can also, if you wish to look further, you can see where that fish came from. We have a track of fishery page on our website. So if you wanted to read a bunch of documents and reports and stuff, you can find out how sustainable the fishery is. But I don't, you know, I think it's pretty rare that consumers are going to do that. I think it, you know, that's why, you know, the blue fish tick, if you see that on a product, you can be assured that it's from a sustainable fishery and it's gone through a supply chain that has full traceability back to that fishery. And yeah, so you can purchase that with no bad feelings.
Mm. Look for the tick.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The blue tick. Yeah.
All right, cool. We won't leave it there. I'll give you the opportunity to, if there's anything else that you wanted to flag for our listeners. I mean, there's a lot of chefs that listen to this podcast, but then also a lot of people that are really interested in food. I guess we just said look for the blue tick then, but is there anything else you wanted to mention while you got a platform, Bill?
Have a nice day.
Not really.
Yeah, I'm you know, it's I'm very positive in life, so that's why I'm positive about the way the fisheries are looking. Mm. I'm positive here in Australia, globally. I know there's challenges, but I think, you know, eating fish is the right thing to do. It's like I said earlier, it's healthy, it's tasty. Don't be afraid.
Great.
Sounds good.
Bill, thank you so much for having us here. Cheers. It's a beautiful spot here in Cronulla. We're overlooking Port Hacking right now. You can see Bundina across the way. Not a bad little office you got. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much for coming, stopping by.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.